Welcome to the Kindle Chronicles, a Friday podcast all about the Kindle. My name is Len Edgerly, and this is episode 43 for Friday, May 15, 2009. I'm recording late Thursday evening in downtown Denver because tomorrow I need to finish preparation for a workshop that I am going to present next week in Honolulu for the staff and commissioners of the Hawaii State Foundation on Culture and the Arts. So by this time next week, my wife and I hope to be reading our Kindles at the Ala Moana Beach Park near our Honolulu hotel. Now, a podcaster less devoted to his listeners might be tempted to take a week off under these circumstances, but at this point, I'm already planning a special Mahalo edition to upload sometime on Friday, May 22nd, the day before we will return to Denver. I'll have more details about that at the end of the show. This week's interview is with Stephen Peters, author of the recently released Kindle Culture, Tales of How Amazon's e-reader is Sparking a Cultural Revolution. The tech tip, prompted by a suggestion from Pat Hahn, will explore the mysteries of battery life and whether 'tis wiser to put your Kindle to sleep each night or turn the power all the way off. The Kindle quote will be from Felonious Jazz, a hard-boiled mystery novel published on the digital text platform that is doing very well this week in the Kindle store. I will have comments from Billy Bogard, Dan Myers, John C. Adamson, Carl Bunker, April Doris, Tom Lichty, and an audio comment from Dan Barnett. You can subscribe to this podcast at the iTunes or Zune stores or by going to the show notes page at thekindlechronicles.com. With that, let's turn to this week's Kindle news. The Kindle DX, which is available for pre-order, shipping sometime this summer, rocketed to the top of the Amazon.com electronics store immediately after the announcement on May 6. It's now slipped to number 3, but the number 2 item is the $29.99 leather cover for the Kindle 2, and number 1 is, you guessed it, the Kindle 2. Now, I would have thought this was clear evidence that the DX is selling very well and that it's not hurting Kindle 2 sales, but Stephen Windwalker today put up a fascinating post at his Kindle Nation daily blog that parses the Amazon sales rankings in a way that makes me think the DX may have slowed Kindle sales, perhaps to a trickle. Stephen writes, "There is a rather stunning imbalance between the Kindle DX orders and the Kindle 2 orders that have originated from the Kindle Nation newsletter and website," those are his newsletter and website, "during the past 8 days. I can't say how many orders are involved, but it is not so small a sample that it is meaningless. Between May 6 and May 13 inclusive, over 95% of all these orders have been for the Kindle DX. Stephen also has heard from lots of angry recent purchasers of the Kindle 2 who would have waited if they'd known the DX was going to be announced so soon after the introduction of the Kindle 2 in February. I have to admit this last part baffles me because of how different the DX appears to me compared with the Kindle 2, mainly because of its size. My wife, as an example, has no interest in a DX because it won't fit in her purse the way her current Kindle does, and she has exactly zero interest in reading a PDF on her Kindle. So I'm not sure how typical she is, and based on Stephen's analysis, it appears maybe she's hardly typical at all. Anyway, I'll have a link to Stephen's post in the show notes, and you can check it out. It's interesting reading. One analysis of the DX that's been getting some traction has it that pirates will help make the new PDF-enabled Kindle a success. I heard this suggested on a Leo Laporte podcast this week in Tech, episode 194 this week, and it was also proposed in a TechCrunch post by Jason Kincaid. Kincaid poo-pooed the Kindle DX's prospects as a newspaper reader and a textbook platform, mainly because of the clunkiness of annotating and highlighting on the Kindle. He then went on to add the following. "If you know where to look online, you can find many novels and textbooks scanned in their entirety as PDFs, but until now, pirated textbooks were more trouble than they were worth. Reading them on a computer screen is a pain for obvious reasons. The alternative, printing out hundreds of pages at a time, results in an unwieldy mess that also stands out like a sore thumb whenever you pull it out in class. The Kindle DX changes that," TechCrunch continues. "Just find the book you want in PDF form, upload it to your Kindle over USB, and you've got a perfectly readable and convenient textbook. Sure, students will have to deal with the usability issues I raised above, like slow highlighting, but these books, frustrating as they may be, will be 100% free. That's $300 per quarter in extra beer money. Most obstacles and morals fade quickly in the face of that much alcohol. Now, the Twit crew was also talking about piracy, but their take on it, I think this might have come from Alex Lindsay, was that the pirates and the threat of this might put pressure that would enable Amazon to convince the textbook publishers to make real price concessions on their Kindle versions, enough so that the Kindle version would be a real bargain for students, and it just wouldn't be worth the hassle of dealing with the pirates, because there'd be savings in using the Kindle versions on the DX. There was actually some non-DX Kindle news this week involving the iPhone. Amazon released a nifty update to its iPhone Kindle application so that now when you tap on Get Books at the app's home screen, you're transported to a new iPhone Kindle store that enables you to buy Kindle books just as easily with your iPhone as you could before on your computer or your Kindle itself. It's a very slick new way to make it easy for Amazon to sell Kindle titles via the 37 million iPhones and iPod Touches in use. Fortune's Apple 2.0 blog, in a post titled "Amazon Rekindles the iPhone," explained the logic this way. Since Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos has made it clear that he is far more interested in selling ebooks than he is in selling Kindles, it makes sense for him to put his content on as many devices as he can, and to make reading that content as seamless as possible. Fortune added an update with a twist on the story from Charles Starrett, senior editor at iLounge, who noted that there could be a small wrinkle in the Apple-Amazon relationship. Namely, by selling its ebooks directly to readers, Amazon may have found a way to avoid the 30% cut Apple will start taking this summer when it opens the App Store to so-called in-app purchasing in version 3.0 of the iPhone software. So I like seeing Amazon making news on several fronts in the same 2 weeks. They've been pretty busy lately. And meanwhile, the number of titles available for the Kindle just keeps on rising. Tonight it stands at over 275,000. Pat Hahn was one of the kindled spirits who last week sent me tech tips. She relayed the following. The latest word from customer service at Amazon is never turn your Kindle off. I have no idea why, because I never turn mine off anyway. Well, my own practice with my Kindle 2, and it was the same with my Kindle 1, was to put the device to sleep whenever I wasn't using it, rather than waiting for the auto sleep mode to kick in. I have also been putting my Kindle to sleep overnight, plugged into the AC power with the wireless connection on. I like this because when I get started in the morning, my Kindle is at full power, and the day's copies of the Financial Times, the Washington Post, and the Denver Post are waiting on my home screen, along with the New Yorker if it's Monday. But I was interested to see Pat's tip, and it led me to call Kindle support myself this week to see if I could learn more about power management. My support staffer, who had a slightly different take than the one Pat heard about on the Kindle Boards forum, said there was no problem turning the power off on my Kindle overnight, and in fact he seemed to be recommending that. I realized I didn't even know how to turn the power off on my Kindle 2, so he showed me that if I slide the switch on the top of the device to the right and hold it for about 5 seconds, when I release it, I won't see the usual screensaver indicating sleep mode. Instead, the screen is blank. I actually kind of prefer this because I'm getting a little tired of the built-in screensaver images of Oscar Wilde, Emily Dickinson, Virginia Woolf, et al. And after a brief trial with the custom screensaver hack, I decided I preferred having my Kindle hack free so I can receive updates automatically without having to remove the hacks and then reinstall them. The drawback to turning my Kindle off at night will be that when I fire it up in the morning, I will have to go fetch my newspapers. But the Kindle support guy said that will probably take only a minute for all three of them. Actually, I tried that this morning. I turned it off last night. It took more than a minute. It was sort of an irritating amount of time in the morning to have to wait for those publications to load to the Kindle, as opposed to just having them there when I leave it in sleep mode. But What my Kindle support guy did offer on his own as a battery management tip is that it is a good idea to let the Kindle battery drain to near zero and then recharge it at least once in a while. And that's not my usual practice. I always fill my car's gas tank up when it's at about half full, so that's how I manage my Kindle's battery. He said the long-term life of the battery will be better if I cycle all the way down from time to time. He also said it's not good for long-term life to overcharge the Kindle battery by leaving it plugged in for, say, 2 days straight. I don't think I've ever done that because I read my Kindle a lot each day, but I've made a note to not leave it plugged in if for some reason I'm going without it for more than a day. I assume these tips apply to the Kindle 1 as well as the Kindle 2. The on-off process for the Kindle 1 is actually more straightforward because you just turn that power switch on the back on or off, and then there's a separate switch for the wireless. If you have any thoughts on Kindle battery management, please let me know, and thanks to Pat Hahn for suggesting this as a topic for this week's Tech Tip. Steven Peters has been writing about music and pop culture for more than 20 years. He was given a Kindle last fall, and that led to his writing a new book available on the Kindle titled Kindle Culture: Tales of How Amazon's e-reader is Sparking a Cultural Revolution. It's available just now for $4.79 in the Kindle store, and it's the first book I've seen that focuses on the Kindle as a cultural phenomenon. And Steven's a good storyteller, so he's got a lot of intriguing anecdotes about the way people are using the Kindle. I interviewed him by phone on May 11. He began by describing the moment he first had the idea to write this book.
I was looking through the Kindle boards on Amazon, and there was a lot of photographs that people had taken the time to post, and I would not have thought of taking my Kindle on a vacation and taking photos of it in exotic places or the ways that people were using it. And one of the first photos that really caught my eye was a photo of a couple being married with one, and it was very clear in the photograph. Everything else was kind of what you'd expect in a wedding picture, except for the minister was holding a Kindle. At about the same time, I had joined an online group at booksummit.com called Kindle Social Network, and had met a woman there, one of the welcoming committee, who had cerebral palsy and found that the Kindle had enabled her to read again after not reading, which was one of her favorite things to do, but she had been unable to do so because it's very difficult with her equipment. And those two things together kind of made me wonder whether or not there might be something worth exploring as far as writing something about. And right around that same time, I learned that Amazon had offered the DTP, or digital text platform, enabling authors, independent authors, to upload their own things, and I thought that might be a good fit. And, you know, at home raising a baby, so I'm not really doing a full-time job right now, and thought, well, while I have a chance, maybe I'll see if I could put something together. That's kind of how it started.
What did you learn in your own experience with the DTP that you'd pass along to others that are thinking of publishing a book for the Kindle using that platform?
Well, I had limited experience with it. We actually tried self-publishing a short story that my wife had written before we put the book out, just to see how it came out, and the formatting was pretty good, but ultimately I decided to enlist the talents of Joshua Talent, who you've, I believe, had on the show,
right,
to look over my file, and he put it into a PRC form. So it uploaded great. It was very, I mean, the weirdest part about it for me, and I think a part that authors, independent authors, are at a slight disadvantage is the difficulty in really saying when the book will be out because of that 12 to 72 hour time frame that they provide. But besides that, it looks good, and I think for my next project I'd like to try learning a little bit more about that, because it's an interesting option. It really is.
Now, is your book out there without digital rights management protection, or does it have the DRM?
I think currently, if you get it on the Kindle through Amazon, it has whatever they put on it to make it an AZW file.
Mm-hmm.
But I also have a PRC version that either later in the month or maybe early next month, I want to try getting it in just a normal e-reader format. as well as possibly a print-on-demand option. And when I first thought of it, because it was about the Kindle and really Kindle-focused, I perhaps short-sightedly assumed that, you know, the Kindle owners are going to be really the only ones interested. But since then, I've had a few people ask me, you know, how they could get it without a Kindle. So I think that's maybe the next step. But for right now, it's exclusively a Kindle, Amazon Kindle offering.
Your research, I thought it was great because you sort of dug into the whole cultural aspect of the Kindle, and in the blurb for the book, you raised the question as to, is it going to be a cultural icon like the hula hoop or the VW bug or the iPhone? Where do you end up? Do you really picture the Kindle in the Smithsonian someday based on your research and the writing of the book? Or what do you think the chances are that it is going to achieve that iconic status?
I think the chances are maybe a little less now that the subsequent versions have been a little more streamlined, I guess you would say. I think the character of the original Kindle, for me, it was kind of like the Cadillac Finns of the 50s. It had a very unique character to it. Now, design-wise, I don't know, but I still think that ultimately, especially if e-readers continue to grow in the way that they seem to be, that when some element of that ends up in some kind of museum, that the Kindle would be the most likely candidate, because I still think it had and has the most character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I'm going to hold on to mine in the storage bin of our condo, because I can just picture 20 years from now some grandchild pulling it out and going, wow, you actually had one of these?
Well, that's true. I my first computer was a Mac Classic, and one of our favorite shows, this show Chuck, it turned out that the master computer was based on a Mac Classic. And it is just one of those things that comes around. These things that are so unique, and I don't care what genre or what the object is, there's always some kind of sentimental attachment, and then another generation that finds it unique for its own reasons. So, and especially if it's still functioning. I mean, that a Kindle One, dug out of a chest that you can still turn on and have the Wi-Fi and everything, that would be, just as functional as it was the day you bought it, presumably, so.
Now, your book came out, did it come out just before the announcement of the Kindle DX?
It came out, I actually put it up on May 5th, but the date is listed as May 4th, mm-hmm. And I didn't even know that the DX, I was so buried in trying to kind of get the last revisions done and get it up, and after a couple of self-imposed deadlines that had to be extended, that I didn't realize until I heard from you, actually, that the DX was even on tap that Monday that they announced it. So it was just timing. It wasn't sure. It's like, is this good timing or bad timing? Because I didn't think, that I was going to be able to make a particularly big splash anyway. So I think it probably would only help me as more people started looking into the new Kindle and maybe came across the book or the site.
Yeah, I think so. Do you see revision where you might get into the discussion of the textbook market a little more because of the DX announcement?
I think so, for a couple of reasons. One, I had a couple of times that, I wanted to get this thing done, and by the time it actually came out, and the one review, somebody was kind enough to review it on Amazon, and one of the things that they did mention was that they wished it was a little bit longer, mm-hmm. And I feel the same way. I had a lot of great quotes that I didn't fold in, and that maybe later in the year, now that there's something actually specifically to revise it for, maybe I'll have a revise an extended version in the fall or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Because I there is a lot more to write about and a lot more to expand upon. But one of the hardest things about this for me versus previous projects was that the story still goes on. It doesn't really end, and it's hard to chase a tech story. I had to kind of draw the line, and I did have a moment when I heard about the DX of, should I wait and put some DX? But I think ultimately it's better to take some time and actually explore that, because the education chapter definitely used some more information now. So
I was interested in the part of the book where you talked about the social media aspects where we might be able to share annotations with each other and do some of the things that some of the forums are doing, like the one that Abhi does. But did you come away from it with a vision of what a sort of a socially networked Kindle might look like among readers, and what kinds of things do you think would be cool to do for that?
Well, I there's all kinds of good ideas. I think Sean Reiser has some great ideas about, you know, ways to maybe enable book clubs that would go across the country, and people could add their notations and other people could pick them up, and maybe even integrating it with Shelfari, which Amazon had bought. So I personally kind of straddle the fence between what is the full extent of the social interaction I would want to have with somebody versus just reading a book. But I do enjoy book clubs, and I think that it would be fun if you had hundreds, even thousands of people reading the same book and were able to filter the comments maybe in the same way you can do with certain Twitter applications. And the possibilities are endless. It's hard for me to get my mind around it. But really the things that Sean and I think librarian Garrett Van Dyke also had some good ideas about that.
The librarian passages that you had were fascinating too, because it just seems to be a lot of unknowns as to whether library use, where people could sort of check out Kindles with content on it, violates the term of service or not. And did you end up just basically confused about that, or what's your sense of where that situation is with libraries and where it's headed?
It really was unusual, because I'm not much of a business guy, but I've never seen a company kind of conduct any aspect of itself in such a way as to be so unclear. It's almost like they accept it, but they don't really condone it. And I think the most telling element was when the Library Journal tried to address the issue either the second or third time, and they really came away with an inconclusive answer. So if they can't get to the bottom of it, then, you know, I don't know. It seems like a case-by-case basis. So I didn't really get any clarity on that. I was glad to be able to talk to a couple of people about it, but short of trying to, you know, talk to somebody at Amazon, and it seems like the people that have done that have not had conclusive answers. There really doesn't seem to be a clear answer to that.
I was impressed that there were librarians that were being so proactive about it, because when I think of a library, I think of a big building full of real books, and how come they didn't feel more threatened by the Kindles so that they were actually able to enjoy experimenting with it?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I noticed that a handful of libraries that get mentioned are most of the directors or the people involved in those decisions are really curious about technology, and a couple, I believe the Sparta Library had already used, I don't know if it was iPhones, but they'd already tried to check out the technological aspects or possibilities for libraries. And I kind of went back and forth with whether or not I was going to be able to do a chapter on libraries and education because of the questions, and really happened to come across a comment by Garrett Van Dyke at Brigham Young University Libraries about on Twitter about that he had had a positive answer from Amazon about using the device in his library. So I asked him if he'd comment, and that kind of brought that chapter back to life. It was recent information, but it still seems to be a case-by-case basis. But the libraries that have adopted it seem to enjoy it, and I'm right now in the process of trying to find as many libraries as I can that have Kindles so that I can offer to give them free copies of the book. Mm-hmm. And what I found, I've got about 10 or 11 different libraries that go from public libraries all the way to high school libraries. So there's definitely some forward-thinking librarians out there.
Really? Yeah. One thing I remember when I spoke with Ian Fried, and I asked him about libraries, and he seemed open to doing things that would enable use of the Kindle in libraries, but as with some of his other answers, it was always if we have enough response from customers saying they really want that to happen.
Right.
And I would think that would be something that you would see a lot of people wanting to happen, so maybe in response to that they'll be a little bit more proactive response from Amazon.
I think part of it too is because, you know, it seems pretty clear that Amazon didn't create it with that kind of model in mind, but also the affordability for libraries and the, both of the Kindles I have seem pretty sturdy, but it's not the kind of thing of where a book it can really take the wear and tear. So I'm not sure ultimately if it would work into a really large library systems plan, but mm-hmm. I definitely think there's a possibility for it. I'm very excited about that and the education possibilities. I think it's really kind of moving towards where people thought it would in the last year, year and a half or so.
Have you spotted any more mainstream pop references to the Kindle since you finished the book? I love the one with Josh Whedon's Dollhouse where someone threatens to they'll throw the Kindle at you.
Right.
Have you seen any more examples of it creeping into the pop language?
No, I haven't seen that so much. It seems every once in a while that the most likely place to see it turn up is in some celebrity's hands. I remember the picture of Cameron Diaz walking across the street with one that turned out in a star, but I haven't, you know, it might be a while yet before it's familiar enough. I mean, that seemed almost inside at this stage for them to bring that out, but a lot of people posted about it on Twitter, which is how I first heard about it.
Yeah, when I do a search on Twitter for Kindle, there's just a steady flow of stuff.
Yeah, it's there's a lot more people starting to advertise things, and I didn't really hop on the Twitter train until maybe about a month ago and felt, you know, late to the party, which is often the case for me, but it's really something, and I've made a lot of good friends on there too, and ended up getting a lot of the spots in the book that I wanted to filled in with a lot of comments from some great people.
That's cool. Well, yeah. What's your next writing project?
I don't know. I'm thinking about, should I try to do something else for the Kindle? My wife and I started an imprint called Arte and Terra Press, and the first thing we're going to do is a project for my late niece, who my sister-in-law is starting an organization called Rita's Rainbows, and we're putting together a book of her poetry and art, which is really quite incredible. And that'll probably take me into the summer, and then I have to decide. So I'm very excited about this and very excited to do something else, but right now I'm kind of navigating my way through learning about click-through advertising and trying to get this out there as best I can, you know.
Is that on the web, your press that you mentioned?
We're setting up at arteinterra.com. It's ArteInterra. And right now the main site for the book is kindleculture.net.
Okay.
And ritasrainbows.org is the charity that we're going to be working for here in the next couple of months. So.
Cool. Well, great. Book sales going well, or what's the initial?
I just checked, and so far 27.
Good.
I'm still kind of learning my way around. I made a video, like a Kindle Culture commercial I just posted to YouTube, and I'm just kind of trying to try different things and get the attention, but I think this might be just something that people come upon if they get the Kindle, perhaps, and I'm hoping for the best, but I don't know if that's good or bad. We're pretty happy about it.
Yeah.
It's a start.
I think, I suspect it sort of builds slowly, and it's real easy to buy it. I bought mine last night. I was reading the PDF that you sent me, and I thought, no, wait a minute, I better buy this, so I bought it. I'm one of your 27 purchasers there.
Cool, thank you. Thanks, Lenny. I'm sorry. I had a lot more stuff from you. I want to get in there, and if I do an extended version, I mean, we had a great conversation, and there was a couple of things. My wife was very patient, and you know, at first it was going to be the end of March, and then it was going to be the middle of April, and then finally, they said, "Look, let's just, you know, I got to kind of make something happen by May." So I'm happy with what I have, and I think I hope people will buy it for under $5. And if it gets good response, then, you know, definitely try to do something else with it later in the year.
That's good. Well, I think it's a real good contribution to the culture that you're covering, because you've come at it from different points of view, and I found it a good read. So
I'll recommend
it to listeners.
Like I told you, I still find I find things every time I look at it, but I think that's to be expected. So,
yeah, it's probably a curse of Kindle publishing, because it's always so easy to think about going in and revising it, whereas if it's on paper and print, you're not quite so haunted by that.
No, and I don't know what is considered right in that regard. I mean, if I already it had misidentified somebody, and I had to put in a page of photo credits. Mm-hmm. So those are minor things, but I mean, what is considered revision. I would feel obligated to, if there was any substantial part of a book that was different, to somehow let them know. But it seems like you can just post a new version, and that's,
well, in talking to Stephen Windwalker, it seems like there's some complexity with how you do that as an author on the DTP, and how, if people buy the book, are they able easily to get a revision of it? And I've also been talking with Dave Emerson, who has the Kindle cookbook, and my impression is that there's still some work to be done to have that be a smooth process for an author that wants to put out an update.
See, that would be, very important to me if I was going to come out with something later in the year, that everybody that already bought it could have it from us.
Mm-hmm.
And, outside of, having people send me their receipt and sending them a PRC version, I'm not sure how that would work. But,
yeah, and how do you know who they are? And, it'd be great if there was some simple way to send a notice to everybody's Kindle saying there's a new release out. But I think they're a ways away from having that kind of a process.
Right. Are you, did you decide if you're going to get a DX or not?
Yeah, I bought it as soon as the link went up, so
that's good.
I hope summer means June, not August, but I'll really be looking forward to getting my hands on it. How about you? Are you going to get one too?
Yeah, I think we haven't ordered it yet because the first day, Teresa, my wife, is very good. She will say, oh yes, of course you have to have it. Look, you've just written this book.
Well, that's right. That's the benefit of having the podcast is I have a much shorter conversation with my wife as to whether I'm going to be able to buy the next version of the thing.
So it works out that way, and we haven't ordered it yet. And I'm wondering, do you think that they pushed that announcement up a little for any reason, or do you think that that's when they were planning on doing it?
I don't
know. It's kind of weird they don't have a date.
Well, it is, and Joshua Topolsky was raising the same question. I kind of assumed it might have some preemptive strategy to it because there's a lot of rumors that Apple is going to put out this media tablet that could conceivably be a competitor to the Kindle in June. So they might have wanted to get a jump on that. But I think, too, just if you're thinking of this happening big in the fall on these six campuses, that some lead time for people to get excited about it and work the deals of the publishers and the universities, that it would make sense to let everybody know it's coming.
By that token, too, they might wait till late summer because that's, again, when the buzz, for the fall.
That's right.
So, well, we'll see. I'm curious. I can't think of a time I've ever pre-ordered something not really having an idea.
That's right. I know. It's like they've got us totally trained here that, there's a link. I could buy it. And then that's all I need to know.
Exactly. But I got my little Amazon associate links going on, that day.
Yep, I did too. So
that whole thing.
I hope that that may enable us to help purchase our own if enough people purchase through those links.
Yeah, that would be great.
That was fun talking with Stephen. And if you're curious about the Kindle's broader impact on the culture, I think you'll enjoy reading his book. You can follow his blog, which is based on the book, at kindleculture.blogspot.com. I received an email this week from Brian Gilmer alerting me to the Kindle publication of his mystery novel, Felonious Jazz. Now, my wife is the mystery reader in the family, so I didn't expect I was going to get drawn into the work when I downloaded a sample. But what did get my attention was the very fine writing, which made it a pleasure to finish the sample, and by then I was hooked. That turned out to be good timing because Brian decided to lower the price to $1.99 for an introductory period. If you want to take advantage of that, I suggest you buy now because I haven't been able to reach him tonight to find out how long the $1.99 price will be in effect. I'm glad to see a digital text publishing book of real literary merit doing as well as Felonious Jazz is. Today, its Amazon sales rank is 342 out of more than 275,000 titles. It's number 2 under Mysteries and Thrillers-Mystery-Hard-Boiled, which is a great category that they have a special hard-boiled mystery category. I can't testify yet to the effectiveness of the plot, in my opinion, since I've just begun the story, but this description of J. Davis Swain III, an investigator at a Raleigh, North Carolina trial law firm, will give you a taste of the writing quality. Jeff, that's what the J stands for, has arrived at the scene of a burglary with a creepy twist, the murder by lethal injection of the family's golden retriever. The quote begins at location 108. Jeff was a tall, blonde man coming up fast on 30. People thought he looked well-bred, and he was well-educated. Yet he had grown up near Charlotte in a working-class family with parents who retained the earmarks of their impoverished South Carolina upbringing. Some part of him felt as if there were holes in the socks underneath his cherrywood Italian loafers. He shut the driver's door of his expensive car parked in this neighborhood. People assumed he belonged here, and maybe he did now. He started up the cobblestone walk. The front door stood half open. Jeff had the impulse to extend his hand to Mickey Roos, but Mickey was busy preventing a homicide. So instead, Jeff made eye contact, jerked his head toward the house. "You ain't gonna believe it," Roos said in lieu of a greeting. "Go on in." Jeff said to the back of the woman's head, "Don't worry, ma'am. Davis Swain from C.B. Allison. We're going to take care of this." That's this week's Kindle quote from Felonious Jazz by Brian Gilmer. Now, I just checked my email, and I have some late-breaking news on the Kindle publishing front about this book. I had asked him how long he was going to keep the price at $1.99, and Brian just emailed me, "Len, I've been asking myself the same question now that I'm up in the rankings, even more so than at my last note." And his latest ranking is that he's number 152 in the Kindle store. So that's pretty good, out of 275,000. So he's wondering when he should bump the price and to what. If I do raise the price, it will be no higher than $4.99 for now. I was thinking of going to $2.99 next to see how that affected demand, if at all. So this is kind of interesting to see an author who's having some success on the Kindle store try different price points and see what happens. And so anyway, I think the $1.99 price is not going to last forever. But even at $4.99, if he goes to that, it's a good read, and at least based on my initial impressions here. I don't want to represent the whole book, given that I've only read part of it. But he's got me, and I'm sure I'll finish it. Time now for your comments. Billy Bogart emailed me evidence that transfers of articles from the web to a Kindle via the fantastic Instapaper are no longer free. Along with everything else, Instapaper is just one example. "First time I have seen this," Billy wrote. "It was a 15-cent charge from Amazon, and the item was labeled Instapaper, May 12th.html, personal document service via WhisperNet. It informed Billy that the charge would appear on the credit card statement as AMZN Payment Services. I myself noted a similar charge for a larger PDF file that I downloaded, but instead of 15 cents, my charge was 60 cents because it was a pretty good-sized file. If I'd known it was going to cost that much, I probably wouldn't have clicked on Instapaper's Read Later bookmarklet for that particular item. So I'm sure we're all going to be a lot more careful than when we transfer and convert wirelessly to our Kindles compared with the good old days when charges were stated but never collected." Dan Myers offered this thought on Andrei Pushkin's idea from last week's interview for a hack that might wirelessly transfer clippings from a Kindle to an email address. Dan wrote, "Maybe I misunderstood, but it sounded like an illegal use of the WhisperNet. If a Kindle is hacked, to send to another email address might not be a good idea. Perhaps a better solution would be to connect the Kindle to a computer via USB, cut, paste part of the text file and email from the computer rather than the Kindle. Although who knows, technically Amazon is already receiving the changes to the clippings and the application would be sending the clippings somewhere other than Amazon. Maybe Amazon could make the clippings available on the Amazon website." John C. Adamson offers the following caution. "If you've ordered a Kindle DX, you'll find that Amazon makes the DX the default destination for any downloads. On a book, it makes no difference. On a paper or a magazine, it's a problem since that content is linked to one device. I found this out over the weekend," John writes. "When I ordered a copy of the Sunday UK Independent and it didn't download, looking into it, I found that it was sent to my, quote, second Kindle, which was defaulted as the download destination on the order page. I did an online support ticket and they corrected the problem. Their service is really good. However, I believe it's asinine to default downloads to a device, the DX, that doesn't even exist yet. Anyway, I recommend that your listeners who have bought the DX check the download destination if they order magazine or newspaper content. Well, thanks for the tip, John. This would be a problem only for subscriptions purchased after you bought a new Kindle. My existing subscriptions are coming in fine to the Kindle 2 because they're all bought prior to when I ordered the Kindle DX, but that's an odd little glitch. Carl Bunker was the first one to tip me off to a sad but inevitable development, thanks to the Authors Guild. He wrote on May 12, "This appears to be new as of today. Some Kindle books are appearing in Amazon with the text, 'Text-to-Speech Not Enabled,' below the title information. I just did a quick scan of some popular books and found that 14 out of 42 books had this annotation. I use TTS a lot for nonfiction books. Having that robot voice reading fiction just wouldn't feel right to me," Carl says. "I'm hoping that the proportion won't be as high for the nonfiction as it is for the novels I polled." I'm seeing a lot more Kindles in the wild myself lately, and so is April Doris. She emailed me from her BlackBerry yesterday, boarding the plane from Charlotte to Chattanooga. Two other Kindles in the terminal. I'm so excited. I usually never even see one. I was on a flight probably from Boston on my last trip, and walking down the length of the plane to the restroom, I came across two people reading Kindles, so they're definitely starting to show up. A newspaper publisher from Oregon helped me to understand why the New York Times and other Amazon newspaper partners for the subsidized Kindle DXs would stipulate that the deals would only apply to subscribers not in the local delivery area. He emailed, "I can't speak on behalf of other newspapers, but were I to publish to the Kindle, I too would probably omit my immediate circulation area. Why? To protect my advertisers. If I were an advertiser and became aware that readers of the paper in which I advertise could get the same news without my ad via the Kindle, I wouldn't be as inclined to renew my advertising contract." But that kind of thinking only applies to today. Admittedly, e-readers have a small impact on newspaper and magazine readership at the moment, but I wonder what the long-term effect will be. Will the e-reader versions contain ads? Will there be multiple versions, one with advertising and available without a subscription charge, and one without ads for which the newspaper charges? We're standing on the brink of a paradigm shift in the communications industry where, of brute necessity, newspapers and magazines are the first to peer over the edge. It will be enlightening to see who sees what and how they will respond to it. Thanks for all your good work. Your podcast makes the end of the week even more exciting. Tom Lichty, Portland, Oregon. And finally, Dan Barnett sent in a fairly lengthy audio comment that raises the question of text integrity in Kindle and other ebooks. He wonders if there might be some kind of digital integrity site that could serve as a clearinghouse for readers to alert each other about texts which have flaws. If you are interested in helping Dan pursue this issue, please send me an email at podchronicles@gmail.com and I'll put you in touch with him. Here is his audio comment.
"Hi, Len. This is Dan Barnett, and I really enjoy the Kindle Chronicles. It's a great treat on Saturday morning. I sent these thoughts to Stephen Windwalker and want to know what you think, or perhaps your listeners, and that is questions about the shape or the content of the text on Kindles and, of course, other e-readers as well. And by that I mean not whether the text is DRM, whether it has digital rights management, but is the text in good condition? And a number of things have happened recently that leave me kind of scratching my head. Here's an example. Recently, I purchased Clarissa, which is a huge epistolary novel from Samuel Richardson. I purchased a Kindle edition and then another e-edition and then compared the two. And one of them, not the Kindle version, had links to all the various letters. And there's hundreds of letters, and so those links are important. The Kindle edition had no links at all. I could tell that from the sample first chapter, but sometimes that really doesn't come through. Here's another example. Recently, there's a book published by the University of Chicago Press called Splendid Vices, and this is about virtue ethics. And it's a big scholarly work, And it turns out the list price for the hardcover is $55. The price for on Amazon is about $43. And the price, believe it or not, for the Kindle edition is $39.35. So it's a very expensive digital edition. I downloaded the first chapter, and the text renders pretty well, although it's quite large, on my Kindle 2. But the footnotes are not linked. And even though the chapter titles are linked, the footnotes are not. So you would have to go to the footnotes and do a bookmark or something like that to keep switching back and forth. Well, when you download the first chapter, you can figure that out. But wouldn't it be great to have a digital integrity site where people could put that information in on that specific edition? There's some other things that have come up dealing with that. A recently published history book, and I forgot the title, has some Russian names, and the Cyrillic is not rendered very well. And you apparently can't see this from just the first chapter, but as you get into the book, as one of the reviewers on the Amazon page for the Kindle edition of that brand new book said that don't buy the book because the names don't render very well. Some publishers seem to be doing an OCR of the printed book and then putting that up as a digital edition. Recently, a friend of mine published a book with Doubleday, and there was a quote from C.S. Lewis right at the very beginning, but it said C.G. Lewis very clearly, and it looked like a bad OCR scan. And so even major publishers seem to be doing this. Other publishers seem to be using the uncorrected galley proofs. There was actually a book I downloaded from as a Kindle edition, can't remember which one, but the cover said uncorrected galley proofs. And so it's pretty obvious that that's where the electronic version is coming from. There's also another problem, and that is, for example, take Penguin Classics. When you see this wonderful Penguin Classic edition, sometimes it'll say, get a Kindle edition, and you click on that, and yes, you do get the same book by the same author, but it's, who knows what translation, it's not prepared by Penguin Press itself. And so somehow that needs to be identified. I imagine that Amazon's computers are just going out and saying, well, here's it's not a Penguin version, but here's that same book, and so we'll link to that. But there's a huge difference. Is this a Penguin translation with all the various footnotes and so forth, or is this an older, out-of-copyright translation that may not be very good? That is, what's the integrity of the digital text? Well, I suppose I could go on, but how do we establish, or should we establish, or could we establish some kind of place that keeps track of these digital editions and draws from reviews and reader comments and so forth to let people know what shape the text is in? For scholarly works, that's incredibly important. For a romance or a science fiction story, perhaps much less important. Anyway, what do you think? This is Dan Barnett. Lynn Edgerly, thank you so much for the Kindle Chronicles. Bye-bye.
If you would like to leave an audio comment, it's really simple to do. Just call 206-666-2713. That's like a regular phone message line, so you just leave a message and you can re-record it till you get it the way you want it. I think probably the best length for an audio comment is between 1 and 2 minutes, but if you need longer than that, as Dan did, feel free, that's okay. You can also email me at podchronicles@gmail.com or leave a comment on the show notes page, which is at thekindlechronicles.com. We had a lot of good comments hit the show notes page, so be sure to check that out, and you'll see those in text messages just on the page itself. If you'd like to be included in the Kindled Spirits email alert list, please drop me an email at podchronicles@gmail.com. What that is a list of people who I email the moment that I upload a new episode, and I also send out occasional alerts and questions related to late-breaking Kindle news items. Next week on the island of Oahu, I have an appointment to interview Roxanne Darling and her husband Shane, creators of a wonderful video podcast called Beach Walks with Rocks, which you can find at beachwalks.tv. It turns out they are sharing a Kindle One with help from their two iPhones using the Kindle iPhone app. So I think there's some chance to learn about some Kindle partner relationships. And also it's going to be a nice chance to interview them on the beach where Roxanne does her walks, filmed by Shane. They've been doing this for several years, and they're really just very simple but poignant, moving, a lot of inspiring stuff that Rox talks about, and she has quite a following all around the world for these podcasts. So it's going to be a treat when I'm in Hawaii for my wife and I, Darlene, to meet them and to do an interview there on the beach. Looking forward to it. Music for my podcast is Ramonk by Eval Monagat on the Variations in Time, a Jazz Perspective CD by Public Transit Recording, courtesy of IODA PromoNet. This is Len Edgerly from downtown Denver for the Kindle Chronicles, reminding you to read different. I really appreciate your taking the time to listen to my podcast. Have a great day. Mahalo.